This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with constitutional law expert Marjorie Cohn.
Attorney Marjorie Cohn addresses the immediate threat that Trump, through his Attorney General Barr, has made to suspend the writ of habeas corpus.
Attorney David Gespass joins us from Alabama to talk about houses of worship, especially those that are defying common sense and good public health practices.
These are the mega churches. They're not only by congregating in the thousands and rubbing shoulders in the same room, they're not only threatening themselves, but they're also threatening the rest of us when they go home.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Good morning, Michael. How are you doing up north?
Well, it stopped raining finally. It was biblical. 4 days of it. Sun's out. I'm doing good. Yesterday morning at 7:30, I drove through the rain to the supermarket 15 miles away. They have senior hour at 7:30. You should have seen the scene in the parking lot. All these old people wearing bandanas. It looks like they were on a collective burglary. How are you doing, Heidi?
I'm doing well, Michael. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, you're in the epicenter of the pandemic.
Yes, and one of the things I wanted to mention in our first few minutes is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has a new report out as of the time we're recording this. I think we already knew this, but they're saying definitively that persons who have chronic underlying conditions such as lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, seem to be at higher risk of severe illness from COVID-19. The 78% of the patients with the virus in the United States who need admission to intensive care had at least one underlying condition. And sadly, 94% of those who died had an underlying condition. Yeah. So this is a first preliminary snapshot. They based it on data from about 7,000 cases in the U.S. and about 200 deaths. And these results are consistent with what they found in China and Italy. So it's not really a surprise, but it's good to have the hard facts.
That leads me into what I wanted to say about older people in prison. We did a show with Victor Pate on that. Here in New York State, there are 10,239 elderly people in prison. And of course, these people tend to have underlying conditions. And they're living in a situation where the virus can spread through a prison like wildfire through a forest. People can help. Governor Cuomo in New York is setting himself up as a presidential candidate and as a leader, but he's done zero in releasing these people. They are harmless, these elderly people. He should let them go. You can call, get a pen. You can call Cuomo's office at 518-474-8390. I'll repeat, Governor Cuomo's office is 518-474-8390. And ask him to release these elderly people from prison.
Michael, in addition to that, can you talk briefly about freedom of information laws right now?
Tip of the hat to our producer, Jeff Brady, for putting us on to this story. The Freedom of Information Act is a federal law, but they've also got them at the state and city level. And this is called a sunshine law. It's a real victory for democracy. These laws were passed as a consequence of the radicalization of the 60s. Well, using the cover of the pandemic, a lot of state and city officials have shut the window on transparency, so that people who are applying for government records aren't getting them. They're being stalled. They're being turned down. And what I'm worried about is that this may turn into a permanent situation. It's what Naomi Klein talks about, the shock doctrine. They use these disasters to do bad stuff to us. And this is one. The elimination of these sunshine laws could be one. And people should be particularly alert to that danger.
Michael, that's so true. I think what we're going to see is a rash of measures and laws enacted during this pandemic, and then they will remain with us for years to come.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, and this is what our show was about last week as well, when we interviewed Doug Henwood, the situation presents also positive possibilities. I think people are realizing that Sanders' notion of healthcare as a human right and that everybody should have it, I mean, that's so obvious now. Also, the fact that the government can step in and support people economically is obvious. And the fact that the government can step in and take over various factories and use them for the public good, not for private profit, is also obvious. So this is opening up people's notions of how a better world could unfold. And I'd like to encourage people to go to lawanddisorder.org and sign up so that we can send them occasional notices when something is relevant. So please do that, lawanddisorder.org. The Department of Justice is now seeking to exploit the coronavirus calamity to get Congress to give it permission to pick up and detain people indefinitely. At this point, the American people have a constitutional right, if arrested, to be brought before a judge and informed of the charges against them so that they can defend themselves. This is known as the right of habeas corpus. It's a right that goes all the way back to Magna Carta, the Great Charter, a British law originating in the 13th century. The right of habeas corpus is written into the American Constitution and can only be suspended by Congress. Historically, both the American and the German fascist government, led by Adolf Hitler, have used crises and fear that crises generate in the population to expand their powers. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. FDR put 110,000 American citizens of Japanese origin into concentration camps during World War II. In Germany, Adolf Hitler, who was legally appointed chancellor, used the shock of the Reichstag fire, which had burned down the German parliament, to get his enabling law passed. This enabled Hitler, with the support of German big business, to make laws on his own, bypassing the legislature. What dangers do we face with Donald Trump as president? What does it mean to suspend the right of habeas corpus for American citizens who oppose Trump and his big business backers? We speak today with attorney Marjorie Cohn. She's a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, deputy general secretary of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and is a member of the National Advisory Board of Veterans for Peace. She writes weekly articles for Truthout in a series called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. She is currently taking a leading role in the defense of Julian Assange. Attorney Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Marjorie, the last time I saw you was in Los Angeles. You had driven up from your home in San Diego to participate in this marvelous panel in defense of Julian Assange at UCLA Law School. And we had a chance to talk for a bit. And now, a month later, everything has changed. And I'm so glad to have you on the show to talk about the threat of the suspension of habeas corpus. But before we do that, you played and are continuing to play a central role in the defense of Julian Assange. Can you give our audience an update? What's at stake and where is it at now? And how can people get in touch with the defense organization?
Well, in a nutshell, Michael, Julian Assange is in custody in London, waiting to hear whether or not he will be extradited to the United States to stand charges on several violations of the Espionage Act. And this is a political prosecution. He published evidence that Chelsea Manning turned over to him of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo prison. And for that, he has suffered torture, psychological torture, according to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, by being denied medical care for serious medical conditions while he was in London, and now he is facing extradition. So his extradition hearing started, I believe it was in February, and the second part is supposed to continue in May. So, Julie, in light of the coronavirus and the danger to Julian Assange of contracting it and dying from it because of his health conditions, his lawyers have asked for bail. And on Wednesday, the judge, Judge Baratzer, ruled that she denied the request for bail and ruled that Julian Assange was a flight risk. He could not be trusted to be released. And then repeated hearsay that he would prefer committing suicide to being extradited. And also, she's the judge that's going to make the decision about whether or not to grant the United States request for extradition to the U.S., and she appears to have tipped her hand by saying there was a high risk of extradition, which does not bode well for Assange being sent to the United States for trial under the Espionage Act, which is basically treason, which is severely overused. It was overused by the Obama administration, and now to go after him, even though WikiLeaks published and distributed information very much the way the New York Times and the Guardian and Der Spiegel did. But his lawyers have cited his previous health issues. He has a lung issue, which makes him particularly at risk for this respiratory virus, and also this ongoing psychological torture as documented by the UN Special Rapporteur, history of medical neglect. The British government would not allow him to leave the embassy where he had been granted asylum, the Ecuadorian embassy, to take care of medical problems, which just festered and got worse, and his, as I said, his chronic lung disease, and these very severe complications that he could develop if he contracted the coronavirus. Not clear whether or not the prison where he's being held, Belmarsh Prison, would be able to deal with that. For 23 hours a day, he's in solitary confinement, which is its own form of torture. But he exercises for that other hour a day with 40 other people in a confined space. And, of course, he would be at high risk of contracting it. And one other thing is that the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, issued a statement saying that now more than ever, governments should release every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and others detained simply for expressing critical or dissenting views. Now, the second part of his extradition hearing is scheduled for May. There are 3 weeks left to go in this hearing, but it's not clear whether that's going to go forward because of the witnesses who would not be able to travel due to the coronavirus. And finally, Michael, although there have been no documented cases of the virus in the prison where Assange is being held, 100 staff are self-isolating, and therefore he's not allowed any visitors, and that likely, I'm sure it includes his attorneys as well, so how is he going to prepare for his extradition hearing? So that also raises issues of interference with the attorney-client privilege.
And I think that if he does get extradited and sent to the Eastern District of Virginia, that's a hanging court. I don't think anybody's been successful in that court. So we've got a lot of work to do to save his life. How can people get in touch with his defense committee, Marjorie?
Well, several very prominent civil libertarians, including you, including me, are forming the Julian Assange Civil Liberties Defense Committee. This is a nascent organization bringing together many people who have been working for a long time for freedom of the press and to secure his freedom. But until that group has a website, people can go to defend.wikileaks.org.
Thanks, Marjorie. Let's turn our attention to the topic we've discussed between ourselves about this threat to the writ of habeas corpus. And let me start off by asking you this. On March 13, Trump declared that his Department of Justice is asking Congress to allow the Attorney General to pick up and indefinitely detain Americans without trial in violation of their constitutional right of habeas corpus. What does this mean for political dissidents in our country?
The real question, Michael, should be, do we trust Bob Barr to pick up people who are genuinely suspected of committing terrorism or something that's really threatening to our country? And I would say no, given his track record and Trump's track record. And, of course, we know that Bob Barr is a mouthpiece, some say a prostitute, for Donald Trump, that they will do anything to go against what they perceive as opposition to Donald Trump. And that includes political dissidents, and it includes probably Democrats as well. Anyone who is perceived as threatening Donald Trump's perpetual rule. And so I think it's very, very frightening. What Trump has done is to use his declaration of national emergency. His attorney general, his Trump, the Trump administration, part of the Trump administration is the attorney general. The attorney general is proposing to Congress that it grant him, William Barr, Bill Barr, the power to ask a district court's chief judge to suspend court proceedings whenever the district court is fully or partially closed by virtue of any national disaster, civil disobedience, or emergency situation. And that includes pre-arrest, post-arrest, pre-trial, trial, post-trial. This violates habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is one of the original rights in the Constitution. In fact, I believe that it's the only individual right in the original Constitution before the Bill of Rights was added several years later. And it allows, habeas corpus allows people to challenge the legality of their detention in court. The Constitution says that only Congress can suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and yet Bill Barr is proposing that he be able to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and that means that a person could be arrested, never brought before a judge until the judge decides, the judge is, you know, with input from the administration, that the emergency is over. And who knows when the emergency will be over. It could go on for quite some time. So this is very, very worrying.
Attorney Marjorie Cohn, during the Vietnam War, which I actively opposed, I learned that I was on a list of political dissidents that would be picked up in time of an emergency. Do you think the government still maintains a list like this?
The government has maintained what is called a terrorism watch list, which is a federal government database of, quote, known or suspected terrorists, unquote. And in 2013, there were 680,000 people on the watch list. It's called the Terrorist Screening Database, and by 2017, that number had swelled to 1.2 million, including 4,600 U.S. citizens. And so Obama really expanded the number of people on that watch list. And what it did was to establish a secret process that didn't require any concrete facts or irrefutable evidence to designate somebody a terrorist. Even uncorroborated Facebook or Twitter posts could be sufficient to include an individual on the watch list. Now, fortunately, in September of last year, a U.S. District Court, which is the trial court in the federal system, in the Eastern District of Virginia, struck down that watch list as violative of due process. But the judge basically left open the door, ordered the parties to submit supplemental briefs to suggest what remedy the plaintiffs should receive. But this is a district court ruling. It could be appealed to a higher court, and as you said, the federal Court of Appeals in the Eastern District of Virginia is probably the most right-wing conservative court in the country, so this may not be over. But yes, indeed, we also have, thanks to another very important whistleblower, Edward Snowden, the information about the metadata that the government is collecting on all of us. following our the websites we visit, phone calls we make, emails we send, etc. So yes, there is tremendous surveillance out there. There are likely lists. There was another list that that Obama maintained called the kill list, which included people who were targeted for a political assassination, extrajudicial killing in violation of U.S. And international law. So I don't want to freak people out, but yes, the government still maintains these lists, and who knows who's on them.
What does it mean when Trump recently declared himself, quote, a wartime president? Does this have any meaning? Can he remove constitutional safeguards based on that declaration?
No, he can't. Let's look at the national emergency that that he declared.
Yeah, that was my next question. Let's talk about the National Emergency Act.
And just one thing, though, Michael. Trump, who sat on the on any response, refrained from any response to the coronavirus for an unconscionable period of time, making it much worse and undoubtedly leading to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of more deaths, is now declaring himself a wartime president. He knows that wartime presidents are not defeated in the ballot box. And, of course, his number one goal is not to protect the American people, but rather to get reelected. I mean, he's willing to sacrifice people and, of course, protect the corporations. And that's why he's setting these artificial deadlines for lifting the guidelines. But national emergency that he declared on Friday the 13th of March invoked the Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, which provides financial and technical aid to state and local governments, and also the National Emergencies Act, which triggers more than 100 additional powers for the president. He can shut down radio stations. He can freeze bank accounts. He can even deploy the military troops. And he also could invoke his powers under the Communications Act of 1934, which says that when a president proclaims a state or threat of war, and of course he's saying this is a war, he can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communications. That could include television, radio, and the internet. So, yes. He, if there's any president, and certainly most presidents push their executive power to or beyond the limit that is legally permissible, but we can certainly have confidence that Trump will pull out all the stops and go beyond any powers that he may have and put us all in greater danger, I'm afraid.
People are speculating that Trump will use his emergency declaration to suspend the November elections. Can he get away with that? And then secondly, if there is an election and Trump loses, could he declare martial law and refuse to leave the White House? I remember the last point that his former attorney, Michael Cohen, made when he was testifying before Congress. Michael Cohen thought that Trump would never voluntarily leave the White House.
Yeah. Not legally. He cannot suspend the November presidential election. The 22nd Amendment to the Constitution limits presidents to two terms. It's the purview of Congress, not the president, to schedule presidential elections. The more likely scenario is that Republican governors will erect roadblocks to discourage people from voting, tamp down the turnout because people will not be able to go to the polls due to the virus. Well, assuming that these precautions are still in effect in November. And so then it becomes critical to make online voting or mail ballots available to everyone without cost. And in fact, Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, along with a number of other legislators, senators, have proposed a bill that would require states to develop plans to conduct the election in light of what the bill says, quote, the very real threat looming this November, unquote. And it's called the Resilient Elections During Quarantines and Natural Disasters Act of 2020. That's quite a mouthful. It would require that states furnish postage-free absentee ballots with self-sealing envelopes and provide grants worth $5 million to states to pay for postage and to pay for the high-speed scanners to count the ballots. And in terms of declaring martial law, and that would be illegal to declare martial law, but to refuse to leave the White House, that's the danger and the worry, and what you quoted from Michael Cohen is very worrisome. In addition, during the 2016 presidential campaign, Trump continued to claim that the election was being rigged, and in a debate with Hillary Clinton, who was running against him, he refused to commit to accepting the results of the election. In a reality TV world where he says, "Oh, you'll see, wait and see." And that's, you know, it's not very funny, actually, like it is on television. I don't know. I never watched his show, but I assume that there was a laugh or two. But there's nothing laughable about this, Michael.
The Department of Justice also wants to Congress, they want to get congressional approval to suspend the statute of limitations for criminal and civil cases during a national emergency. Why is this dangerous?
Well, this means that the statute of limitations protects future defendants in civil and criminal cases from being prosecuted a great deal of time after the alleged crime took place, when witnesses have died or disappeared, where the evidence has degraded. And so this would be a real violation, I think, of the due process rights of future defendants in both criminal and civil cases. And I think that is, it's very disturbing.
Attorney Marjorie Cohen, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time. But let me ask you one more question before I ask you to tell people how they can follow your work. So far, what kind of opposition to Trump and his Department of Justice have we seen?
Well, in terms of this Department of Justice Attorney General's proposal to Congress to allow him to suspend habeas corpus, there appears to be very strong opposition in Congress. I have not seen anywhere any considerable support for that measure. In fact, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote, quote, two words, hell no, unquote. Senator Mike Lee, who's a Republican, tweeted, quote, in caps, over my dead body, unquote. And Representative Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, absolutely not. Now, I don't know how representative they are, but again, I have not seen any kind of groundswell in Congress for supporting this outrageous request by the Department of Justice to basically suspend the right of habeas corpus.
Well, that's comforting news. Marjorie Cohen, how can people follow your work?
I write a regular column on truthout.org. It's called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. And so if you go to truthout.org, you can find my work there. And also, all of my articles and books and video and radio appearances are archived on my website, marjoriecohen.com.
Excellent. Marjorie Cohen, it's been an enlightening, I shouldn't use the word pleasure, but it's been an enlightening engagement having you on Law and Disorder. And Heidi and I thank you very much for your good work. And we'll ask you to come on again, and you let us know if anything you want to talk about, and we'll get you back on. So meantime, stay safe and you take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael, and you stay well. And I'm sorry Heidi couldn't join us, but stay well, Heidi.
Well, we have technical limitations because we're recording remotely, and we're trying to get equipment so we can all be on. But at least we're getting things going. Anyway, Marjorie Cohen, thanks so much. You be well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, sheriffs arrested Rodney Howard Brown, the head of the River at Tampa Bay Church in Florida, for ignoring local orders against mass gatherings due to the COVID-19 pandemic. They said he showed reckless disregard for human life. Hillsborough County Sheriff Chad Cronister said he had no choice but to take action against the pastor. He said his reckless disregard for human life put hundreds of people from his congregation at risk and thousands of residents who may interact with them this week. The sheriff said his office had direct contact with the church, telling it not to pack its pews. Instead, he said, the pastor actually encouraged his large congregation to meet at the church. In response, Howard Brown said his church has an absolute constitutional right to gather for worship. He told the congregation the church is an essential service. But religious exemptions during the pandemic will only worsen it and claim more lives. Yet that's precisely what government officials are doing. They're ignoring public health warnings and refusing to call on houses of worship to close. They're establishing religious exemptions, in this case, by freeing houses of worship from public health order compliance. Joining us to talk about this is attorney David Gespath. David is a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. He practices law in Birmingham, Alabama. David, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me. Always a privilege.
Although you were born in New York, you've lived in Alabama for over four decades now. David, did you know that Mississippi, Alabama, and other southern states are among the most highly religious in the nation, and that your state, Alabama, ranks number one in religiosity?
Well, let me tell you the story about when we first moved down here, went to a Mexican restaurant that was decorated with beer bottles all around on the walls. So we asked for beer with our meal, and the server said, oh, no, we don't have beer here. And she was very friendly and said to us, so what church do you belong to? So we got an idea right away about the level of religiosity here. And plus we got a number of phone calls from people asking us to come to their churches. I mentioned one time that I was Jewish, and this guy said, oh, that doesn't matter. Our pastor just preaches the gospel. So, I got that idea pretty quick.
Why do you think the South is so religious?
You know, I think the history of the use of religion as a means of maintaining control and oppression is particularly stark in the South. You know, enslaved Africans were inculcated with religion as a way to keep them subservient and obedient. Religion was also used as a justification for chattel slavery, and the Bible is kind of like, lemon, right? People can interpret it however they want for their own purposes. So there was much about it that also taught poor whites who were suffering that they were better off because they were better than the African descendants who were enslaved. You know, I keep thinking of Bob Dylan's verse in Only a Pawn in Their Game. He said, the South politician preaches to the poor white. I said preaches to the poor white man. You have more than the blacks. Don't complain. You're better than them. You were born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. And religion has been one of the primary drivers of that ideology.
Well, we're going to talk a bit about houses of worship in the wake of the coronavirus, but I want to ask you first about Alabama's lack of preparedness for the fallout from the virus. I understand that 17 hospitals have closed in the state over the last several years. Why is that?
Primarily because Alabama, like so many southern states, particular and states with Republican governors, refused to expand Medicaid. So hospitals, particularly in the poor areas and particularly in rural areas, just couldn't make any money because so many people coming there had no insurance and they had to be provided with care. But the hospitals received no compensation for the care they provided. So most recently, Pickens County, the hospital there was not only the one hospital in the county, it was also the largest or one of the largest employers in the county in a place in the Black Belt and West Alabama that is particularly poor and already has a disproportionately high level of unemployment, then some 200 employees were out of work because the hospital simply could not sustain itself.
Now, I have not been following the statistics about the numbers of individuals infected with the virus in your state. Has it hit hard yet?
It has, in the sense that proportionally, Alabama is a relatively small population. It doesn't have huge municipal areas like New York. It's not as compact and not as dense. And we have, I think now, well over 1,000 cases and have had a number of deaths. But in terms of the population and per capita, what I've understood is that Alabama's rate of infection is comparable to New York State.
And how are the hospitals dealing with the influx of patients?
So far, they've been able to manage. So far, they have not been overburdened with, you know, they've had, I think, University of Alabama at Birmingham Hospital here in town. Last I heard, had some 60 patients, 30 of whom were on ventilators. It's managed thus far, but if it gets any worse, things are going to get really bad very quickly. A friend of ours, a neighbor, lives across the street, is a nurse at a hospital, and they're very low on masks. So protective gear for healthcare workers is at a premium, and as the virus multiplies kind of geometrically, hospitals are going to be hard-pressed to manage, just as they are in other places around the country and the world.
David, several federal, state, and local orders specifically exempt houses of worship or other faith-based institutions. I was surprised that New York includes guidance on essential services saying that, quote, houses of worship are not ordered closed. However, it strongly recommended no congregate service be held and social distance maintained. Other states that have similar exemptions for religious institutions are Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, Louisiana, Ohio, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Mexico, West Virginia, and Kansas. Remember during the AIDS epidemic, David, we saw a lot of stigma attached to individuals who were seropositive. What do you think of the reaction to the coronavirus compared to decades ago when the AIDS epidemic was at its peak?
Yeah, what I recall is people getting prosecuted for having unprotected sex and not telling their partners that they were seropositive before that. And prosecuted for serious felonies, you know, like attempted murder. And I think that was in large part because back then, the epidemic was mostly confined to drug users and the gay community, so they were sort of this disadvantaged and scorned part of the community to begin with. But now what we're seeing is something that in many ways is much worse, because when churches and these large mega churches have congregations of hundreds or thousands of people, are not practicing any kind of social distancing that's worth anything, they are not just endangering the people next to them. They are endangering entire communities. And what we see is a couple of the preachers have been charged with misdemeanors, and these guys, if they have to pay a fine of $500, it doesn't cost them anything, really. But in fact, they are, in ways very similar to people who engage in unprotected sex, but on a vastly greater scale, condemning multiple people to death. And the fact that they are not treated as criminals in the same way that seropositive people were years ago really indicates the kind of difference in status and perception that we had. And I'm not necessarily advocating a pastor ought to be charged with attempted murder for violating these rules and procedures so much as they shouldn't have done that with the guys before. But I am saying those pastors who are engaged in this behavior and are absolutely defiant about being told to limit it are doing things that are far more dangerous than infecting one individual.
David, on a sidebar, the journalist Chris Hedges, who's been a frequent guest on Law and Disorder, spent 2 years researching and investigating the megachurch phenomenon. He interviewed pastors and congregants, and Hedges concluded this was the base for an American fascism. Have you given any thought to that?
It is certainly a part of that, I think, because their interest is in imposing their view of Christianity on the entire country. And that is a very restrictive view. It's also one that fails to recognize or accept the diversity and breadth of the community in the United States. You know, who was it that said that fascism in the United States would come on a white horse? I think that the evangelical right is certainly a part of that. And indeed, I think the other thing that's happened is that right-wing zealots and reactionaries have managed to mold religious thinking to advance their ideology by raising things like anti-LGBT views and restrictions on abortion as being sort of religious precepts, which they never really were before the reactionary right built this unholy, as it were, alliance with the religious right. And the religious right, by the way, is a sort of recent phenomenon. It's not something that you talked about 50 years ago.
Some of President Trump's top evangelical supporters are blatantly ignoring science during this pandemic. Jerry Falwell Jr. said the virus was a North Korean bioweapon, and one Trump advisor speculated it was a judgment from God. Even Paula White, who's a special advisor to the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative, headlined an Evangelicals for Trump rally in early March, ignoring public health warnings. What message does that send, and what are your thoughts on these advisors?
It's very interesting. I just saw something from an old high school friend of mine on Facebook when someone asked a Trump supporter, an evangelical Trump supporter, how they could possibly support somebody who reflects none of the characteristics of a Christian. And the answer was two words, Supreme Court. What this is a way of, you know, people say religion is the opiate of the masses. It is always just a way to deceive. I don't believe for a second these leaders, so-called leaders, necessarily subscribe to the views that they espouse. But they gain prominence and they gain wealth as a result of them. So I think that it is, once again, just a means to an end. And that end is creating a state for their followers appears to be, you know, like the good old days, which never existed. But for them, is a matter of more wealth and power.
David, you're a prominent civil rights attorney in Birmingham. You must know many faith leaders because of your work in the community. What are they thinking about the virus, and are they still holding services?
Well, the ones I know are, you know, are very concerned. No, they're not. You know, I know that the Friends meeting is meeting electronically and virtually now. My activist friends are not holding services. They're finding other ways to engage with the community and engage with their congregants without having to have them come to one place. What is most distressing is the Church of the Reconciler, which is a church that serves the homeless community here, has had to reduce the services that it provides to a community that is particularly vulnerable because they're not just homeless, which means that they can't really practice sheltering in place, and they're also very oftentimes physically compromised. The other thing I say is that, among other things, I am on the board of CARE Alabama, and I have a lot of Muslim friends, in particular with what is a religiously very conservative masjid here outside of Birmingham. They, too, are just not holding services. They are not doing it because they understand that presumably God gave people the ability to think and understand science, and that should be utilized rather than ignored.
On the other hand, David, we have people like Pastor Rodney Howard Brown, who says this church will never close. Pastor Tony Spell of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, told the Washington Post they felt they were being persecuted for their faith. And some ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities are still congregating. If you were the governor of those states, what would you say to these people of faith, and would you enforce the laws of not congregating?
Yeah, as I said before, I would tell them and tell their congregants in as most clear as terms as possible that they are not just endangering themselves. You know, if they want to go and meet, you know, and take the risk for themselves, yeah, that's their business. But they are endangering everybody in their towns, everybody in their communities, everybody that they come in contact with, and even people who they do not come in contact with, because people have to get out and buy food and whatever. You know, the virus spreads all those ways. You know, and I would say absolutely, one, you are not exempt because of your religion, from your obligation and your responsibility to your fellow citizens and residents not to endanger them. I would absolutely want laws to be enforced. You know, on some levels, I wish that the laws were a little stricter in terms of potential liabilities. Because it's Alabama, you know, I would invoke what our former senator and the former attorney general, Jeff Sessions, said in another and not quite appropriate context. But, you know, he said, you should listen to Jesus' wise counsel and obey the laws of the land. And maybe someone would pay attention to that, because it was actually some biblical quote that Jeff Sessions came up with.
I never thought I'd hear you quote Jeff Sessions, David.
I never really planned to, not certainly not favorably. But then again, I'm probably not going to be governor of the state of Alabama anytime soon, so I probably won't come up.
Sadly, faith communities are starting to feel the impact. I understand that the first person who died from COVID-19 in Baton Rouge was the Reverend Leon Franklin, a Baptist minister. Oklahoma had a death in Reverend Merle Dry, a Pentecostal pastor. And in Italy, as of the date we're recording this, at least 60 priests reportedly passed away from the virus. And that happened in the course of a week. I imagine we're weeks behind them, but unfortunately it seems that we'll be following suit in terms of increase in fatalities.
I think that's probably the case. And it's hard to say why that has happened, other than the fact that, of course, large congregations get together and there's more exposure, and much of that may have happened, particularly in Italy, because the response was slower than it might have been. And because, by the way, you know, people can be asymptomatic and also carriers of the virus. It's not, in some ways, surprising. Faith leaders and members of churches have been exposed disproportionately. One can't criticize them for that. One can only criticize them for not recognizing the danger now and for their ignoring it.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to note that there are online resources that faith leaders are using to connect and to support each other. There, I think, is a private Facebook group. As you alluded to, I think many religious groups are conducting their services online. What are your parting thoughts on the state of where we are and what needs to happen in the next month or two?
Well, it certainly seems to me, in most places in the country, we have not reached the peak. One hopes that, you know, New York, where you are, things are leveling out a little bit after the really devastating last month or so. We're not getting the kind of leadership we need. It's sort of like from the president, he started out by setting the bar so low for a response that now that he's doing something, everyone thinks he's doing so well. By the way, it seems odd to me, you know, all these people remember that Obama said, if you like your health care plan, you're going to keep it, and a few people weren't able to, and 10 years on, they're still talking about that, but no one seems to remember what the president said 2 weeks ago about how this is okay and nothing's going to happen, we'll be okay. Now he's saying we'll do a great job if we have 100,000 people die. You know, this thing, unfortunately, has taken the entire world by surprise. It's particularly unfortunate that in this country we are not as prepared as we should have been when there was all sorts of warnings about the need to prepare long ago. On the other hand, what we see, too, is all sorts of acts of, you know, societal aid and figuring out ways to assist and ways to help each other. It's a time that we'll have to see. It can either lead to a sort of renewed sense of community, or it can lead to greater repression. I fear the latter. I hope for the former.
Well said, David. We hate to let you go, but we hope to talk with you again during better times.
I would love to talk to you during better times, Heidi. It's always a pleasure, even in these bad times.
David Gespass, have a wonderful day, and thank you.
You the same. Take care.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.